We must never accept the premise that they put forward, because it is a lie. They are not religious leaders, they're terrorists.
This week, President Obama states his position in a roiling debate about how to describe those who commit acts of terror. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In the aftermath of the Chapel Hill shooting, Middle Eastern commentators accuse their American counterparts of double standards.
Arabs and Muslims want to have an influence of how their religion is portrayed in the American media. Right now, it's being hijacked by extremists like ISIS.
And why the American government's and media's focus on the threat of Islamic extremism might be dangerously misguided.
More people have been killed by the American radical right than jihadists of any kind since 9/11.
There's more coming up after this.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This was the week of Islamo-consciousness. Shooting rampages in Denmark and North Carolina, one with a Muslim suspect and one with Muslim victims, raised angry questions of prejudice and double standards in the coverage of violent crime. Meanwhile, the cautious language surrounding a White House summit on suppressing extremism saw its national security agenda overshadowed by a highly politicized debate over language, namely the accusation that political correctness has trumped political reality in confronting radical Islam. Here's Ted Cruz.
The words radical Islamic terrorism do not come out of the president's mouth. The word jihad does not come out of the president's mouth.
The soft-on-terrorism refrain is a familiar one, and as we shall hear later in this hour, probably unavoidable for a president whose words are meant for both domestic and foreign consumption. For instance, Obama was upbraided this week by Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan for not attributing the murder of three Chapel Hill College students to anti-Muslim hatreds.
If you, after an incident, an attack like this, remain silent, the world will also stay silent with you.
It was not merely the president, however, who was accused of double standards in the wake of the February 10th North Carolina bloodshed. In that case, a professed religion hater named Craig Stephen Hicks is accused in the shooting deaths of Dia Shadi Barakat, his wife Yusor Muhammad, and her sister Razan Muhammad Abu Salha. The murders were in a small city, and the victims' names weren't released for 9 hours, so the incident at first received no attention from the national media. But with two Muslim victims in headscarves and the accused gunman's anti-religious Facebook rhetoric, anger and speculation quickly bubbled up on the internet at what seemed to have all the makings of a hate crime. Yet the U.S. media were slow to react. They were scooped by the British newspaper The Independent, and when the New York Times did report the story, it left the victim's religion out of the headline. Critics were quick to compare this with shooting attacks last weekend in Copenhagen, where the dead gunman, Omar Abdulhamid al-Hussein, was instantaneously branded a terrorist.
Denmark has been hit by a very serious act of violence tonight. We feel certain now that it is a politically motivated attack, and thereby it is a terrorist attack.
Now, that attack took place at a free speech seminar explicitly convened in the wake of the terrorist murder spree at Paris's Charlie Hebdo magazine. Nonetheless, that rush to judgment was conspicuously matched by the Chapel Hill police, who quickly ascribed their murder case to a long-simmering neighborhood dispute free of any anti-Muslim motivation.
Meantime, it was a parking dispute in North Carolina that led to the shooting deaths of three people. Police say
Hicks, they said, was obsessed with illegal parking and noise in the apartment complex, and notwithstanding his loud anti-religionism, was an equal opportunity crank who harassed neighbors regardless of their race, creed, or national origin. An interpretation either duly reported or uncritically embraced by the national press, depending on your viewpoint. Certainly the victims' families were having none of that. This was Suzanne Barakat, sister of one of the victims, on CNN.
Had roles been reversed and the man was Muslim, was of Arab descent, was of South Asian descent, this would have immediately been labeled an act of terror. I haven't heard anyone use the term terrorist here. Why the double standard? He has terrorized our families. He has terrorized our lives. He has terrorized our community, locally, nationally, and internationally. And it's time that people call it for what it is.
Soon, complaints of bigotry and indifference traveled far and wide, echoing the aftermath of the deaths of unarmed black men by police in Ferguson and Staten Island. The hashtag Muslim Lives Matter soon flew across the internet and around the world, inflaming the Islamic State and the president of Turkey, sick of the presumption of Muslim guilt.
Just look at this. It's trending with almost 900,000 mentions so far today.
We've devoted most of this week's show to the difficulty of addressing the volatile combination of religion, politics, extremism, prejudice, and perhaps more than anything, language in what they used to call the war against terror. And we'll begin by looking at the word terrorism itself.
Last month, BBC Arabic service head Tariq Kafala spurred a semantical controversy when he announced that the BBC should not refer to those individuals who attacked Charlie Hebdo as terrorists. Such a choice, critics said, was outrageous and gives succor to terrorists. Conservative MP Conor Burns classified the whole affair as, quote, yet another example of Orwellian 1984 use of language by the BBC, which serves to mask rather than illuminate. Though, in fact, the BBC does continue to use the word terrorism. David Shariat Madari is a deputy opinion editor for The Guardian and author of its Buzzwords language blog. He witnessed the outrage incited by the BBC's Kafala and set out to explore the unique history and nature of a fearful word. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
One of the odd things about terrorism is it is effective only if people are outraged. In a sense, it's a crime of violence, but it's also a kind of mass communication.
Yeah, possibly the distinctive feature of modern terrorism, it is a form of message sending. In the research for this piece, I was reading an article by David Fromkin from 1975, at the peak of the kind of new terrorism which was occurring, which targeted civilians. He says, all too little understood, the uniqueness of the strategy lies in this, that it achieves its goal not through its acts, but through the response to its acts.
So we're pretty clear in general terms about what terrorism is, at least in the early part of the 21st century. And yet it is so fraught that the head of the BBC Arabic service thinks that it's best to let the listeners and viewers decide for themselves and for its reporters to use simply descriptive language. Why?
I mean, the BBC are quite clear that words exist already in the vocabulary to describe these kind of events, whether they be bombings or attacks or whatever. And I think the BBC guidelines describe the word terrorist as a characterization, and that they don't want to be in the business of characterization. They want to be in the business of description. The word risks becoming a bit of a participant in the cycle of fear and reaction. There's a risk that the word gets used for something beyond that mere factual description.
Well, clearly, it has a history of being abused. The Nazis used it to describe underground groups, partisans and so forth, that attacked Nazi soldiers. And to this day, we see illegitimate states and others using it to describe mere political protesters. So clearly, it's abused. But if others are abusing the word terrorism, should the press be intimidated into abandoning a word which means just exactly what it means?
No, I don't think so. And actually, The Guardian, we have a manual of style which doesn't forbid the use of the word terrorism, but it advises caution and it asks that we use the word judiciously. I think the BBC has made its own decision. I can understand it, but I wouldn't necessarily throw the word terrorist out of the lexicon. But we just have to be careful with it.
Now, I'm hinging this whole line of questioning on the notion that we all perfectly well understand what terrorism is. And that as long as the press uses it properly and does not allow itself to be manipulated by politicians and others, that it should not be taken from our lexicon. On the other hand, terror hasn't always meant what we understand it to be now. Its roots go back to the original state terrorism, do they not?
The word terrorist and terrorism entered the English language at the end of the 18th century, at the time of the French Revolution. And it was used to describe the activities of the revolutionary government, the Committee for Public Safety, as it styled itself, which had taken charge in France and conducted essentially a political purge against its enemies. And that period became known as the Reign of Terror. And because that climate of fear was attended to by all the other nations in Europe, because it was such a tumultuous event, the word entered various different languages. It entered Spanish, Italian, and English. But initially it was used to describe a revolutionary government's activities against its people and its political enemies.
And now it's almost entirely flip-flopped. It's used to describe the kind of asymmetrical warfare where people who can't take on a government can nonetheless get the attention of the world by committing various kinds of atrocities and outrages in the way that we've seen ISIS been doing for the last year or so. Since terrorism isn't complete until the reaction to it has taken place, particularly in the press, I'm just curious if the press actually pulls back on its use of terrorism for fear of getting caught up in politics, did the terrorists win or did the terrorists lose?
If news organizations were going to be more judicious in their use of the word, I wouldn't see that as the terrorists winning against the media organizations. I think it would be at least partly the media organizations deciding not to participate in a cycle of fear.
David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob, for having me.
David Shariat-Madari is deputy opinion editor on The Guardian's UK comment desk and author of the Buzzword series.
As we heard, refraining from using the word terrorism may seem judicious, but sometimes it's construed as bias. The hashtag Muslim Lives Matter was sparked by outrage over the murders of the three young Muslim Americans in Chapel Hill and by the American media's response to it, marked both by belated coverage and the failure to characterize the murders as a kind of terrorism.
News of the killing spread across social media. Hashtag Muslim Lives Matter and hashtag Chapel Hill Shooting raised questions about whether hate was a possible motive.
Egyptian officials cautioned against the growing victimization of Western Muslims. The Lebanese government called the killings terrorism and a crime against humanity. Palestinians in Gaza protested and decried the double standards of the West.
Muslims, especially all over the world, are berating the American media for not playing up what they see as a religious aspect to these murders.
Rana Swice is a journalist based in Jordan, where two of the murder victims had citizenship. She says that in the aftermath of the shooting, social media in the Arab world was quick to condemn mainstream American coverage, which took a full day to report the story.
Well, I think really it's about holding the American media that prides itself in objectivity and independence and freedom of speech to a higher standard than Arab media. In the Arab world, so much of the media is controlled by governments and there's so much self-censorship. There is an expectation that there will be media bias, but they hold the American media more to account. So we saw, for example, the hashtag hypocrisy used a lot to describe the media in the U.S.,
and there have been some reactions from cartoonists as well.
A famous cartoonist in Jordan, Osama Hajjaj, posted on Twitter a menacing depiction of Mr. Hicks in the colors of the American flag. So his hair was red and his pupils were stars and he had a blue nose. But his beard and his mouth, which were black, resembled an Islamic State militant dressed in black and saying terror has many faces. We've seen many social media posts attempting to liken Hickens with Islamic extremists accused of killing Americans. A week ago Friday, the front page of Al Ghad newspaper, an independent daily newspaper, had photos of the three victims and the headline was Two Jordanian Victims of Hate Crime in the U.S. So the judgment on Mr. Hicks was already made that this was a hate crime.
How did they process the initial reports out of Chapel Hill that this was over a parking dispute?
It was seen as a joke. The reactions, I think, stem from this feeling that Arabs feel they are under siege inside and outside the Middle East. In a way, under siege from ISIS that is pretending to speak in the name of their religion, which, of course, the majority are against. And also this legacy of U.S. interventions in the region that have left deep scars on the regional psyche, including, I think, a feeling that Americans see any Arab as an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I noticed is that there's, of course, hate speech on both sides, very extreme Americans saying racist things online, and vice versa, of course, people here using hate speech against Americans. But there's also a constructive dialogue and legitimate questions that I think are really spurring a debate that we should pay attention to. For example, some Americans are saying, look, Muslim lives matter. They really do. But when Muslims are thrown off buildings by ISIS, where's the outrage?
I assume there must be outrage.
There is, but we have not seen the same reaction even online. And, you know, arguably, Arabs are asking, where was the West in terms of intervention when hundreds of thousands of Sunnis were killed in Iraq? America intervened when their journalists were killed. So a lot of interesting questions. I think it's a very healthy debate that came about from the Chapel Hill executions.
Nihad Awad, the National Executive Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, said, quote, "This case is quickly becoming a touchstone for the American Muslim community's sense of security and inclusion." Is there a sense that it's a touchstone in the region as well?
Arabs, and I think Arab Americans and Muslim Americans, feel that because of their insistence on creating the hashtag and making noise, if you will, on social media, they feel that they force the mainstream media to cover this properly. So there is a sense of empowerment that has emerged from this incident. And Yusor and Razan, the two victims who were Jordanian Americans, you know, they're regarded by Muslim Americans and people here in the region as regular young people, you know, seeking a high quality education, a career. They really represent the majority of Muslims in the West who are seeking exactly the same things. So there was a sort of identifying with the victims.
Speaking specifically of Jordan, which was recently shaken by a horrible video of a pilot being burned alive by ISIS, do you suspect that this climate has anything to do with the reaction of the Arab world to the Chapel Hill shootings?
It's not something separate, but it's also a little different. Arabs and Muslims in the region, they want to have an influence of how their religion and their faith is portrayed in the American media. Right now, it's being hijacked by extremists like ISIS. So this incident really made them want to have an influence on how this story is covered because of who the victims were. The two women immigrated from Jordan seeking, you know, education and a better life and success, and they achieved it in many ways. And then they were brutally killed, you know. So Arabs wanted to make sure to show another side of Muslims and Americans and a way to demonstrate that there's another side to these people.
I see. The coverage is there not just because it's an outrageous murder, but because at the center of it are two or three model young people, people with whom anybody can identify. Rana, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Rana Swice is a freelance journalist for the New York Times and a media researcher in Amman, Jordan.
Coming up, what to call the terrorism within.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Meredith from TLDR. Our last episode created a little bit of controversy. We stumbled into a pretty heated issue. This week, we take a look at our role in that. Give it a listen. Thanks.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the White House held a 3-day summit on countering violent extremism. Its aim was to forge a multi-pronged strategy to counter extremism of all forms. But the focus on the summit has been on language. Politicians and pundits alike have been harshly critical of President Obama's choice of words when describing acts of violence perpetrated by ISIS and its affiliates.
We're not at war with violent extremism. We're at war with Islamic radicalism, and you cannot defeat an enemy if you won't even name it.
This is a very easy way to look at this. They are terror denialists. They deny terror at every place.
Indeed, the president has been condemned by both the right and the left for refusing to use words like Islamic or jihadist in his remarks on acts of terror. Scott Shane is a national security reporter for the New York Times. Shane says that the latest bout of presidential censure is a long-standing political problem.
The labeling goes back to the beginning of the Obama presidency when an army psychiatrist named Nidal Hassan had a shooting spree at Fort Hood and killed 13 people. And former Vice President Dick Cheney took Obama to task for not calling that out as Islamic terrorism. There's always been, on Obama's part, a reluctance to put the religious label on acts of terror or, indeed, radicalism. And there's a logic to that, but I think many Republicans and some Democrats and some counterterrorism officials at this point would say perhaps the logic has gone a little bit too far.
The logic being, I guess, that to the extent that each of these acts is characterized as a jihadist act of terror or an Islamic act of terror, it helps spread the narrative that the West is engaged in a cultural war with Islam instead of with the individuals behind particular episodes, right?
That's right. Part of it is that words like jihad and Islam have a huge authority in the Muslim world, and to hand those labels over to Al-Qaeda or to ISIS to affirm that what they call a jihad is in fact a jihad in religious terms would be a real problem. And that's why the Obama White House has been very careful not to say that. And that does receive a lot of support, certainly in the American Muslim community, but also among a lot of counterterrorism folks. They say you're in a war of ideas and a battle of ideas. And you certainly don't want to suggest that Al-Qaeda and ISIS are Islam. You want to treat them as a murderous criminal offshoot that falsely claims the cloak of religion as opposed to conceding that they represent the religion.
The problem is that shouldn't we all be able to keep two apparently opposing ideas in our head at the same time? One, that terrorists and extremists like ISIS do not represent Islam and its billion-some faithful worldwide, but to also hold in your head the notion that they are themselves acting in what they perceive to be the interest of Islam. If you don't acknowledge both, isn't there kind of disingenuousness that the Republicans have seized on?
I think that's the problem that has come up, and it's partly because us in the media naturally grab for the common sense label that conveys to readers or viewers what an incident is about. So if someone at Fort Hood yells Allahu Akbar and shoots up a lot of people and is Muslim, and when you look at it, seems to have been considering whether attacking his fellow soldiers would be a religiously justified act of jihad, we immediately label that as Islamic radicalism and so on. When everybody else in the discussion, notably everybody in the media, is using these labels of Islamic and jihadist, and the White House is not, it makes their language sound evasive and pallid by comparison. And once that framework is set up, you know, they kind of can't win.
Now, leading up to this summit, there's been a fair amount of debate in the press and among pundits about the words we use to describe and frame this challenge.
Here was the president on Wednesday describing the quandary that he is in.
We must never accept the premise that they put forward, because it is a lie. Nor should we grant these terrorists the religious legitimacy that they seek. They are not religious leaders, they're terrorists.
It's understandable, Scott, that the president does not want to give oxygen to terrorists in their perverse ideology. There is the question, though, of what his responsibility is to the American public. Michael Flynn, a retired Army lieutenant general who ran the Defense Intelligence Agency from 2012 to 2014, said the president does have responsibility, which he doesn't believe he's meeting. This is him speaking at a House hearing last week.
You cannot defeat an enemy that you do not admit exists. And I really, really strongly believe that the American public needs and wants moral, intellectual, and really strategic clarity and courage on this threat.
Is Flynn right? Does the government have to acknowledge the threat in order to defeat it, or is actually the opposite true?
You know, one of the folks that I talked to about this, Akbar Ahmed, who's a professor and chair of Islamic Studies at American University, said that there had come to be what he called a scholastic feel to some of Obama's language, and that he thought that was a problem. And he said that he came across as sort of making ivory tower distinctions and that he needed to get down into the hurly-burly of politics. And several people I talked to about this problem recognize that the White House has a dilemma, but they thought that you could resolve it by saying that this is a strain of Islam that the vast majority of Muslims reject, as opposed to using very generic words like violent extremism and ignoring the claims of ISIS and al-Qaeda, however unjustified.
So if the president has to worry about all the different ears listening to every word he utters, is there any sense, particularly in the midst of this summit, which ears he's most concerned with?
For the most part, this is a purely domestic political issue. But the fact is that some of the Muslims he has to avoid offending are much more important than just a relatively small group of ordinary American citizens. And those are leaders of countries, some of which are now our allies in the fight against ISIS, and certainly other places in the fight against al-Qaeda. And many of these leaders regularly say, when there are acts of terrorism by al-Qaeda or by ISIS, this is not Islam. Part of what motivates Obama is that he does not want to appear to be labeling this stuff that his allies have said is not Islam as Islamic. So part of what's going on here is any president speaks to an international audience of great importance in addition to his domestic audience.
Scott, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Scott Shane is national security correspondent for The New York Times.
Mark Potok, senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, does not share Shane's view. He thinks religious qualifiers are both misleading and a distraction from the source of most domestic terrorism. For instance, this week a man was found by the FBI with stolen explosives that a witness said he planned to use to bomb a federal courthouse in Elkins, West Virginia. Last month, an Ohio man was charged with attempting to kill federal officers in Washington, D.C. The day after Thanksgiving, a man shot up downtown Austin, Texas. All of these alleged terrorists were American. The Southern Poverty Law Center's quarterly journal, The Intelligence Report, has just released a study called The Age of the Wolf, about the rise in so-called lone wolf domestic terrorism. Potok suggests that Americans would be safer if, in the public mind, the word terrorism were not reflexively joined to Muslim extremist or jihadist, because on our shores, that's not where the danger lies. Mark, welcome back to the show.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So your study covers the last 6 years of domestic terrorism in the U.S., during which you cite 63 acts of terrorism. But what did your study find?
That these kinds of attacks are quite frequent, really just as frequent as they were in the 1990s. We found that there was a domestic terrorist attack once every 34 days, if you averaged it out.
Wow. And what tends to motivate them? Are they Islamic extremists, or are they white supremacists?
5 of the 63 incidents we looked at involved jihadists, but that needs some explaining. We were not looking at Americans, for instance, who go abroad, say to Syria, and we're also, of course, not looking at Islamist extremists coming from abroad plotting against the United States.
Now, the Southern Poverty Law Center released this study last week in advance of this week's White House Summit on Countering Violent Extremism, and I don't assume that the timing was coincidental.
No. We decided to release it in advance because it seemed more and more apparent that the government has been paying very close attention to the so-called Islamist threat and paying really far less attention to the other half of the terrorist spectrum, our own homegrown radical racists and so on. We think that the government really must remain aware and cautious about the threat of domestic terrorists.
Because you found that in the U.S., since 9/11, we've seen much more criminal violence from the American radical right.
That's right. There have been a number of studies in addition to our own that have shown plainly that more people have been killed by the American radical right than jihadists of any kind, either domestic or foreign, since 9/11. For instance, most people probably do not know that the day after Thanksgiving last year, Larry McWilliams opened fire in Austin, Texas. He shot more than 100 rounds at the police headquarters, at the Mexican consulate, and at a federal building there, and intended to go on and kill as many people as possible. He was loaded up with propane tank bombs, a fairly miraculous shot by one police officer standing 320 feet away, killed this man. It later turned out that he was a white supremacist who saw himself as carrying out an attack on the government on the orders of God.
What, in your view, is the difference between a hate crime and an act of terrorism?
Well, a hate crime might be simply, I don't like black people, Jewish people, Muslim people, gay people, whatever it may be. But the point is, it's a kind of personal act. A terrorist act is a message crime, like lynching. If you burn a cross on the lawn of the interracial couple's house, every other interracial couple within shouting distance also is terrorized and also is, in a sense, victimized.
Why don't we pay as much attention to the American terrorist, the homegrown white supremacist terrorist, as we do to the jihadist terrorist?
Well, I think that for many, many, many years, it was easy to think of terrorists as people who do not look like us or think like us or worship like us. Obviously, Oklahoma City in 1995 changed that in a dramatic way. But it's perhaps worth remembering about Oklahoma that in the 2 days before Timothy McVeigh was arrested, a whole string of so-called experts went on national television to say that this attack has all the hallmarks of radical Islamist terror, which it didn't. Oklahoma definitely changed the perception of American law enforcement officials. Immediately after the bombing, President Clinton authorized the hiring of 500 more FBI agents tasked to domestic terrorism. And in fact, law enforcement really cracked down in those years of the late 90s and helped to drive the movement more or less out of existence. But then, of course, along came 9/11, and once again, the attention of this country switched very hard to jihadists from abroad.
And what about the phrase Islamic terrorism. I mean, it's almost like disgruntled employee. They're always joined together, it seems.
Well, this attack from the right on President Obama for not using the phrase Islamic terrorism seems really quite ridiculous. We don't call Larry McWilliams, the man who described himself as a priest in the fight against the anti-God people as he opened fire in Austin, a Christian terrorist. And yet, you know, his actions were explicitly based on his bizarre reading of the Bible. And the list goes on and on. What Larry McWilliams or Tim McVeigh did had very, very little to do with Christianity, and it seems to me that the same is true of the vast majority of what some people would like to call Islamic terrorists.
And I guess that's borne out in this recent poll by something called Christian Lifeway that found that 27% of Americans think ISIS represents the real Islam.
Yeah, it's an incredible poll. And another kind of shocking piece of that poll was the same research organization polled senior Protestant pastors around the country and found there that 45% of those people felt that the Islamic State was an accurate representation of what Islam really is.
So what do you want people to take away fundamentally from your study, Mark?
Well, that while the jihadist threat is extremely real and extremely significant, we have an equally significant threat from our very own people, people born and raised in the United States
equally
of America.
Or greater?
Well, I wouldn't say greater because there is no comparison out there that comes close to what happened on 9/11. On the other hand, we have seen very large numbers of American terrorists plotting to do things on that order. In the late 1990s, there was a case out of Texas in which a group of five Klansmen intended to blow up a natural gas refinery. Their idea was that this would cause such chaos that all police and law enforcement officials would go to that explosion, and they would meanwhile go to the other side of the county and rob banks and finance the white people's revolution, the Aryan Revolution.
These guys watch a lot of movies.
When that plot was prevented, federal officials said at a news conference that had these people succeeded, they would likely have killed between 10 and 30,000 people, 10 times the number of people who died on 9/11. So, you know, while it may be true that people linked to Al-Qaeda are better at their work than some of our own domestic terrorists, it's not for want of trying.
Mark, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
Mark Potok is a senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center and editor of its quarterly journal, The Intelligence Report.
Coming up, after 50 Shades of Grey, I don't think BDSM really means what you think it means.
This is On the Media.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In 1989, American feminist Catherine MacKinnon wrote, "It's not that life and art imitate each other. In sexuality, they are each other." The unprecedented success of 50 Shades of Grey might just be the most provocative new playground for that argument.
My tastes are very singular. You wouldn't understand.
The unprecedented success of 50 Shades of Grey might just be the most provocative new playground for that argument.
Enlighten me then.
Amid all the media fanfare surrounding the film release, there are debates over the movie's power to shape sexual norms. Critics see the film as a pornographic portrayal of abuse. Others see it as a historic shift towards sexual expression and agency. In the middle is Amy Adler. Amy Adler is the Emily Kempin Professor of Law at the New York University School of Law, and her research focuses on obscenity law, feminist theory, and gender and sexuality.
We have this
blockbuster book and now what I gather will be a blockbuster movie featuring what was once considered to be a fringe sexual practice, marketed to middle-aged women in middle America in a way that I think is unprecedented.
And it's kind of interesting because if you see this as a sort of bodice ripper for the third millennium, Harlequin romances have really declined in popularity. And the thought has been that this basically is the bridge too far that Harlequin didn't go, and there was a pent-up desire for it.
On the one hand, we have this extreme worry about female sexual victimization. But at the same time, our culture is so much more explicit than it once was that things like Harlequin just seem extraordinarily tame. What do women want? Women want egalitarian relationships. They want safe relationships. But apparently, there's still some kinds of sexual desires that this movie is tapping into that may look akin to scenarios that outside of sexual fantasy would be extremely disturbing.
On the one hand, the book and the movie seem to be accepting a wider range of sexual practice, but they also seem to rub some feminists, especially some old-line feminists, the wrong way.
There are 50 shades of feminism when it comes to these questions. And certainly one feminist school most closely associated, I think, with Catherine MacKinnon, the dominant school from the 1980s, has been very critical of S&M pornography. So to those kinds of feminists, the release of this movie would be a triumph of a patriarchal order which eroticizes dominance and submission and marginalizes women. That said, many, many feminists disagree with that account. There have been some feminists colloquially called sex-positive feminists who look at women's enjoyment of all kinds of practices, including S&M, as something to be celebrated as an example of women's freedom and agency.
Isn't it just that we have to separate our sexual fantasies and our sexual practices from the rest of our life, that one doesn't have to be a mirror of the other?
And I think that's often lost in discussions about 50 Shades of Grey. I mean, just because people might find it erotic to imagine sexual submission doesn't mean they want to be raped, doesn't mean they want unequal pay. As feminism calls for a more egalitarian vision of marriage, of relationships, what's left of the sexual desire that may be rooted in those outmoded ways of thinking about power? What do we do with them? I mean, there was a really interesting article in the Times last year about sexless marriages and the egalitarian marriage as a less erotic marriage, this problem.
You got to be careful with New York Times trend pieces.
Right. Who knows if it's true or not. But it's symptomatic of another moment of cultural anguish over what is sexuality going to look like in a more feminist era. What do we do with desires that might be considered politically incorrect?
There has to be room in this feminist egalitarian vision for a few ropes and some molten paraffin.
I mean, some feminists would say that's precisely the point, that now we have come to a point where women can reclaim pleasure and freedom, something that was long denied women. At the same time, there is this instinct in our culture that our sexuality is somehow key to our true selves. Now, this is something that we're left with, certainly since Freud. This is something that Foucault wrote about, that our sexual desire is somehow at the root of who we are. It does suggest that there's something erotic about power dynamics, particularly male dominance and female submission, that is something we can celebrate and play with, but also to the extent that we think about our, you know, a sexual desire is at the root of our identities or a significant fact about who we are, then it suggests that structuring a society of equality and at the same time leaving room for sexual pleasure might be more complicated.
If there is discomfort, it seems to me it arises from the fact that people see this as inconsistent with equality and fairness.
Yeah.
And
I just don't see it as inconsistent because I see it as sex and fantasy.
Yeah.
And the big thing here is here's finally some pornography, if you want to call it that, for women. And when has that ever happened before in any big way?
It's just interesting that this is what porn for women looks like, right? And that's funny. In a culture in which we've been so uncomfortable around the topic of female sexuality, this is it. Porn for women. What do women want? They apparently want 50 Shades of Grey. And that's surprising, especially when you consider how bad the writing is in the book. And of course, mainstream sexual desire is shaped by pornographic culture and presumably shaped by other aspects of mainstream culture, including the discourse around feminism. So mix it all together and out comes 50 Shades of Grey. That's a surprise to me. Okay.
Amy, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amy Adler is a law professor at NYU School of Law who focuses on obscenity law and feminist theory. Having sold over 100 million copies worldwide, the mainstream media success of the book and now the film brought a somewhat shrouded BDSM subculture to the fore, a condensed acronym for bondage, discipline, dominance, submission, and sadomasochism. Some in the, quote, kink community suggest that the film might be a crossroads in a civil rights struggle, a stonewall moment that will soften the stigma of non-traditional sexual practices. Dr. Charlie Ferrer, a sex therapist and founder of the BDSM Writers Conference in New York, understands intimately the debate.
For somebody that's looking at it from the outside and going, oh my gosh, they're just hitting each other. Well, that's not true. There's the idea of being able to increase sensation, being able to experience something a little more primal, a little more adventurous. A dominant is someone that leads, takes care of their partner, then the submissive follows. So if we're looking at it from a vanilla perspective, which is what we say for anyone that's not inside the DS community, you're looking at the old-fashioned leave it to beaver type family, where you have the father leads, the wife follows, and the piece that the movie and the book really didn't talk about was that emotional connection that the couples do make. It's just like any other relationship in the vanilla world. It's just more intense.
But it sounds like you're agreeing with Catherine MacKinnon that sexuality is a perfect reflection of how you live outside of sexuality. And, you know, I've known couples engaged in these kinds of practices, and there's no passivity outside the sexual relationship.
But there is, depending on what level of the lifestyle you live. If you're just at the BDSM level where you're just playing, doing some of the things that we do, flogging, whipping, and things like that, then you're at one level. If you're going to a dominant and submissive relationship, it's kind of the difference between having a boyfriend and having a husband.
The movie has been decried by groups like the National Center on Sexual Exploitation and the American College of Pediatricians. They claim it represents a disturbing trend in entertainment media that endorses abuse, threats, and physical violence. So the question is, if there is abuse in the film or something that looks like abuse, how do you explain to those groups what is abuse and what is play?
First, let's talk about the difference between dominance and submission and domestic violence. When you have somebody beating you, they're not going to stop. They're doing it to hurt you. They're doing it out of malice. When you're interacting with someone in the DS community, that's not done out of malice. It's not done with the intent to injure you. It might be done with the intent to bring some pain into the play, but it's not done out of malice. And the intent is very important. Consent is also very important because when you're interacting in a DS relationship, there's a safe word, and the safe word is basically what will bring everything to a halt. I know that there is a scene in the movie where supposedly he whips her, and it's a very unplanned, unnegotiated, unacceptable thing for her. In the DS relationship, there are punishments given in a designated way, whatever you and your partner have agreed to.
Do you think that the perhaps unprecedented success of 50 Shades of Grey is in fact a watershed moment?
I think it's a wonderful opening. In a way, we are stepping into our own civil rights movement because the BDSM community is right now the same place that 20, 30 years ago the gays and lesbians were, where they are being discriminated against, where they are losing their jobs, their homes, their family, their children.
50 Shades. Good for the BDSM community, bad for the BDSM community.
I think it's a little of both. It did bring it to the forefront where people are okay to talk about it, where they always say, oh, the soccer moms are talking about it. Instead of people going, oh, those freaks are doing something. It's now, oh, that's that 50 Shades thing. Okay, no problem. I'm just not into that. The bad part is that it talks about it out of context. It's continuing that misconception of it's only broken individuals who are in this lifestyle and only because they want to be abusive to their partner and only because they don't have any control on themselves and they need to be fixed. And that's not true.
Charlie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Charlie Ferrer is a therapist, sexologist, and founder of the BDSM Writers Conference. We'll link to that on the website. And she's the author of the book, BDSM, The Naked Truth. They tried to warn you, but you misunderstood. And the pain feels good. The pain feels good.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Sara Abdurakhman, Kimi Regler, Mira Sharmer, Kasia Mihailovic, Reem Abdu, and Andrew Chug. We had more help from Jesse Brenneman, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was David Grinbaum.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. And if you like us, here's a couple of things you can do. Go to iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps us out. And also, subscribe to our newsletter. It's timely, it's pithy, and it'll point you to some stuff you'll be really glad you found. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.